You are listening to a podcast from WSUM. Catch UCM Exceptional live on Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on WSUM 91.7 FM Madison.
Hello, Madison, and welcome to UCM Exceptional, an interview show that you're currently listening to on WSUM 91.7 FM Madison. Each week on this show, we'll have a guest on to get to know them and their story. I am your host, Oliver Gearhars. This is my co-host,
Jeb Blossom.
And today our guest is...
Nate Gibson.
So I wanted to begin this by saying I am having you on today because last semester you came in and were a guest lecturer for my folklore class. And I thought that the story you told, this, it's got the history of yodeling baked into it. It's got so much like knowledge of the field, but it's also your personal story of yodeling. And I think that, you know, the blending of personal growth and professional knowledge in that story was really nice. And that's why I wanted to have you on today.
Oh, thanks.
To get some background laid out first, I know folklore mostly as tradition and dynamic variation. You came in, you were a guest lecturer in a folklore class, and I know that not very many people know what folklore is in the academic sense. Can you tell us a bit more about the subject and what it means to be a folklorist?
Sure. Well, the reason I got interested in folklore, my graduate degree is in ethnomusicology and folklore, was because I wanted to study music, but I didn't want to teach people how to play music or that there was a right way or a wrong way or that one way was better than the other. So I went to Indiana where the folklore department and the ethnomusicology department are one. So I studied both at the same time. And the idea for me was to study why we do these things. And I think that that's across folklore and ethnomusicology. How do we make meaning in our life? How do we learn to do the things that we do, and why is it important to continue doing them? So I was interested in folklore and ethnomusicology because I wanted to understand why we play music, what kinds of music we play, and how community is formed around that. And that brought me into the folklore world of just trying to understand where we learn things from, what traditions we keep going, why is it important to know about our traditions, and to how do we make life beautiful, and So that was the basic for why I wanted to do this.
So you said the University of Indiana, right?
Mm-hmm. University. Yeah.
Indiana University, of course. So folklore and ethnomusicology are one department there. Are they always together?
Can you do one
without the other?
It's a unique situation over there. So I wanted to study ethnomusicology, and my first, it's the only university in the country where ethnomusicology is not part of the music program. Here at UW, we do have ethnomusicologists. We have actually 9 ethnomusicologists on our campus right now, but the only ethnomusicology courses that are taught are in the music school. So it's a little different there. Our folklore department here at UW is rooted in the German Nordic Slavic department. And so every university has their own kind of weird structural organization. But I'm grateful that we have folklore and we have ethnomusicology here at UW. They're doing similar things, but they're spread across the campus.
So simply, in the most layman's of terms, what is ethnomusicology?
The cultural study of music. Instead of studying how to play music, we're studying why people play music. So I think of it, for me, as social formation. And a lot of people form community around music, and music has a power to transform and change community. So I'm interested in why we do this.
What got you into that? Was there like a time when music really defined the community you were a part of?
Yeah, music's always been extremely important in my life. And I guess when I was a songwriting major as an undergrad. I studied poetry and song and graduated, obviously, without a job, and as songwriting majors often do. And so I drove trucks for several years, but I was... While I was driving trolleys around Boston, I was taking several months of the year off to write a book about music and to tour with my band and do a lot of music projects. And at some point, I decided I should go to grad school and keep writing books about music. That was interesting to me. But I wanted to write books about why music is important instead of how to play music. So that was ethnomusicology for me.
So how were the trucker years?
Trucker years were awesome. Between undergraduate and graduate school, I took 8 years off. So I graduated as an undergrad with a songwriting degree and $0. And a friend took me in and let me live in a shared room free of rent for a while until I got a job. And that was just the first one that came up. And I gave tours of, I had to get a truck driving license, an air brake license, all those licenses, a Hackney license, passenger license, all these things. And then once you get that, I gave tours of Boston on a trolley, a 2-hour tour of Boston, and telling jokes and basically a stand-up comedy routine while driving through the streets of Boston. I did that on and off for about 8 years.
Were you like from, where are you from?
That's a difficult question to answer. I was born in St. Louis. I spent many years in different towns in Kansas. And I spent 12 years in Boston, which is the longest I ever lived anywhere. I spent many years in Bloomington, Indiana for grad school and after grad school. I did a year and a half of research in Finland, living in Helsinki. And I've been here in Wisconsin now for 7 years. And each place I live, I feel like, is part of where I'm from. That's part of my story. So I'm from all of those places.
I noticed that on your website, how it was a pretty long list. Why did you move around throughout Kansas so much when you're younger?
Well, in St. Louis, my dad was a minister, and he started a school, a K-8 private school, and the church was a supporter of public schools. And there was some tension there about starting a private school, but it was in St. Louis at a time when public schools were going through a court-mandated desegregation, and so there was a lot of tension, stress. There was some violence. A lot of parents were scared, and so I think a school started from the church out of that. But then we left because of the tension that was started there. We went to Garden City, Kansas. My baseball coach and a member of our church was a drug dealer, and I asked my dad for a public recommendation, saying he was a good guy. And my dad said, I don't feel comfortable doing that. And they ran us out of town, and they said, you've got 1 week to leave or else. And so we immediately packed up and moved to Onega, Kansas.
How long were you in Garden City before that?
3 years.
Incident. Wow. That's
three years. It was rough. I don't have a lot of great memories of Garden City.
Yeah, no, it doesn't sound like
it. Yeah, it was a hostile situation, and so we left pretty abruptly. And then we went from Garden City to Onega. That's a town of about 900 people, and my brother finished high school there. I did 3 years, but I in fifth grade, right after we moved in the middle of a school year, because it was so abrupt, we had to leave. And when we moved in, that fifth grade in Kansas is when you start learning about sex ed. And so it was like my first week in this new town, and they start teaching about sex ed, and I couldn't handle it. I just passed out. My head just hit the desk as soon as they started talking about women's anatomy. I was out, and I got made fun of mercilessly for that year, and it was pretty brutal. So I started, I went to school in the next town over, like an hour away, and I bussed an hour each morning to go to Havensville school. I just couldn't wait to get out of that town as well. So when my brother finished high school, we moved to Manhattan. And
Manhattan, Kansas.
Manhattan, Kansas. Yes, thank you. Clarification. The Little Apple. And over there, that was the largest high school in Kansas at the time, and that was really a time where I fell into music. I was doing all these sports in these other towns. I was going to be a pro baseball player. That was the dream. And I realized in this high school, I started off as the number 99 chair trumpet, and I was like, oh, my goodness, this is terrible.
That's so many.
That's so many trumpets. But in Onega, there were 8 trumpets, and I was the 8th trumpet. I was miserable. And every year I challenged, I tried to get to 7th, and they never let me. And they were always like, nope, you're always 8th. Whereas when I was 99th, I kept challenging, and I eventually became first chair trumpet. And so people were very encouraging, and people were saying, oh, you can do this.
That's such a cool conquest.
It was a great conquest.
Yeah. How long did it take to get through the other 98 trumpets?
Oh, by my senior year. But yeah. I was doing jazz bands. I could do symphony. I could do pit orchestras for musicals. I was doing marching band. I joined a punk rock band and played trumpet in a ska band. And there were just so many more opportunities that weren't available to me in Onega. So Yeah, that's when I decided music's the path for me, and did music through college. And even when I was driving trolleys and trucks, playing music, playing in a, started a country band, and yeah.
So you did your undergrad at Emerson, right?
Yeah.
And then we're doing the truck tours for quite a while in Boston. That was your Boston era?
Yeah, that's the Boston era. It was a good era. But it was like a stand-up comedy tour. You'd have to do 3, sometimes 4 tours a day. And a short break in between, but telling the same jokes over and over, like 4 times a day, 5 days a week, for 8 years, it gets pretty old. And so I started taking these classes at Harvard, has an extension school, which Lowell, who you're taking courses with, he was teaching at Harvard Extension for a while. I didn't take classes from him, but I was taking Harvard Extension classes on American history. So the peopling of British North America, and just ways that I could tell the story of the American Revolution with fewer jokes and a little more historical accuracy. And that got me interested in going back to grad school.
Hmm. So now I think we've landed at the part where, from what I remember, your story of yodeling starts. I'd like to ask you to tell the story, but first I'd like to try and see what I can remember about your history and the history of yodeling. So here's what I remember is that it became a part of country music in the early 1900s, peaked in the early to mid 1900s, and has enjoyed some use since then.
Yeah.
And including in a big hit, and then a kid yodeled in a Walmart, and that also, that was big yodeling news.
That's big yodeling news, right? A viral video of this little kid just yodeling in a Walmart, and then a year later, he's headlining South by Southwest, and he's it's really remarkable what the internet can do.
I forgot that part of the story. He went places for a little while.
He did. Mason, young Mason, the yodeler.
I remember you met a lot of important yodelers and learned from them.
That's right. There was a guy when I was doing my senior thesis songwriting project. My advisor was a guy named Rex Traylor, and he was a New England cowboy hero. He had a TV show in the 50s, 60s, and early 70s called Boomtown. And it was strange because every time I would go to meet my advisor on campus, and I'd sit down and we'd talk about certain songs and styles, when we would go out for lunch, he would get stopped all the time by strangers and asking for autographs. And I was like, who is this guy? And as I started researching more and more about it, I realized there was another, he was a big deal in Boston. And there was another guy who was from an hour outside of Boston, who was a children's television host, cowboy singer, very similar career path, named Kenny Roberts. But Kenny was known as the king of the yodelers. And so these two singing cowboys from the 50s with their own TV shows had never met each other, which is crazy to me. They're both in the New England Country Music Hall of Fame, both very iconic cowboy singers in Boston. Never met, so I invited them to meet. And we asked Kenny if he would join our project and yodel with me. So I wrote a song called The King of the Yodelers about not being able to yodel, but being taught by the King of the Yodelers. And he said, sure, well, why don't I actually teach you how to yodel? So I scrapped up all my money that I could get at the time, and I paid for one hotel night in Boston. And he drove in an hour, stayed in the hotel, and gave me yodeling lessons. And it was awesome. And then he yodeled on my record, and it was great. So my first record, I got to sing with Kenny Roberts, the king of the yodelers. And what he taught me was, he sat me down and he said, well, let's try to yodel. And I was like, I really don't feel comfortable doing this. This is not going to be great. And he said, well, just find your falsetto. Just try to sing in a falsetto that's uncomfortable. And that's hard to do in front of people you don't know. It's just try to go, da, 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 da. But he was like, we're going to do the cattle call. Everybody knows the cattle call. I did not know the cattle call, but he said everybody knows it. And so he sang me this song, and in the middle of it, he was breaking his voice down. So it was like, ee-dee-dee-dee-dee-oh, ee-oh.
I think you got to get like 6 to 12 inches further back from the mic while you're yodeling.
Oh,
yeah.
It was like, ee-oh. And he said, once you get comfortable breaking your voice down, then you can go up. So he started very slowly doing like, and when you can start to control that sound, you can start doing different paces, start doing different rhythms, and start learning certain patterns, like ooh-lay-ooh-loo-ooh-lay-ooh-loo. And as you start learning those types of things, it just escalates. And so he was kind of teaching me how to yodel and how to find the vocal range that I had where I could do voice breaks, which became very important as I began meeting other country music performers, doing interviews, wanting to talk to people. I started writing a book about Starday Records, and that was the label that Kenny Roberts had recorded for through the 60s. And Kenny introduced me to a bunch of people who recorded for that label, and I just expressed interest in learning more about Starday. And a lot of folks were a little standoffish. They were in Nashville or they were in Texas, and they didn't know who this kid in Boston was calling and saying, "Can you tell me about Starday?" Or I would go in person and knock on doors. "So-and-so said I should meet you. Would you like to talk to me about Starday?" And they would say, "Well, who are you? Do you sing music?" And I'd say, "Yeah, I can sing music. Sure, I can sing some of the songs you played." And then singing and yodeling with people was a way for me to sort of be part of the country music community, learn about country music, get people talking to me. So it proved very, very effective in my interviewing skills to be able to yodel and to sing with a lot of the people I was interviewing.
Was there any particular person where yodeling was the, where you really broke through?
Oh, man. There were several people who, I think of Oranje Ray Hubbard in Cincinnati. When I went to his house, he was sort of, a lot of people had wanted to interview him, but then they tried to buy his records or talk to him about getting his music, and he didn't want to sell anything. So he's like, "I don't want to sell anything. Do you play music, and what can you sing?" And I said, "Well, I can sing. I like George Jones. I like Jimmy Rogers. I like Kenny Roberts." And he said, "Let's go to my basement. We're going to play music before we actually talk." And so I had to sort of prove myself that I could play these songs. And once we sang songs and I could play the music and I could yodel and I could sing with him, he was like, all right, you're good stuff. Let's go ahead and talk. Let's go upstairs and do an interview." I was like, "All right, I won my keep." So yeah, there were several times where it would be useful.
So I'm guessing his basement was finished.
Yeah, he had a finished music basement. And there was a group of women, Betty Amos, her sister, Jean, and her best friend Judy were a trio that recorded for Starday. And every year in Nashville, we'd get together and just sing songs for a few hours before we would do interviews. And it definitely proved useful throughout my life of creating friendships, keeping that tradition going. And then later, as I became more invested in singing country music and performing it, knowing the history of yodeling and country music, and yeah.
My brain just got torn between two questions. I got to piece them back together. So you mentioned Kenny Roberts and Rex Traylor as two TV legends from the 50s, cowboys. And, I mean, they seem pretty significant to the yodel world, or at least especially Kenny Roberts. Yeah. But when did things get started for yodeling?
Oh, yeah, yodeling goes way back. There's all sorts of yodeling around the world that we can look to for communicating across mountains, communicating to animals and herding animals, or, you know, the yodeling traditions go way back in Scandinavia, throughout Europe, certainly in Africa as well. But the first major country music star, the first big star of country music, Jimmy Rogers, started his career recording in 1927, I believe it was, and he recorded, say, 125 songs in his career, and 120 of them all had yodels. Every single song he recorded, almost, it would say, he would do a blues line and then just do a quick yodel turnaround, like, "Ole-ay, ole-ay, ole-ay," and that's how he would end each line. And so from there, Gene Autry and all these people came along who wanted to copy that and yodel in all their records too. And then people came along in the 1930s and early 40s, like Elton Britt, And in the 40s, Slim Clark and Kenny Roberts and Rosalie Allen and Carolina Cotton, and it became trick yodeling. And there was a whole fad where people wanted to do the fanciest, fastest, highest, loudest yodels.
Like rapping fast?
Like rapping fast. It was pretty cool stuff. But these trick yodels were popular through about the 50s. And then it really, when rock and roll came along, there is a song out there called the Rock and Roll Yodel that just doesn't work. rock and roll definitely kind of took over for a while, and yodeling, it still exists in a lot of places, but it wasn't mainstream country music anymore after that. I don't know. Leanne Rimes had a big yodeling record with Blue in the 90s, and the yodeling Walmart kid found some mainstream success, but for the most part, we don't hear as much yodeling as we used to.
So you mentioned yodeling, you know, used to herd animals, communicate across mountains. So it was an evolutionary advantage, really.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, people cultivate these yodels to do a lot of different things. Country music is really the epitome of yodeling, though.
So do you think that's what gave us the edge over the Neanderthals?
Oh, man. The ability to yodel? Maybe it was. Too tough to say.
All right. Well, I think I'm prepared to ask if you can teach us how to yodel a bit.
Oh, sure. The cattle call, that's where it starts, at least for me, since that's how I learned, that's how I would teach other folks how to yodel.
I think now is the moment to mess with the mics a bit. Okay. Maybe turn them down to like negative, maybe bump it down to like -5 on all of our mics.
Okay. Yeah. For anybody listening who wants to try this on their own, there are several karaoke tracks to Cattle Call on the internet. Partially because Eddie Arnold had a big hit with it, but also because Elvis Presley did it. So you can find all sorts of cattle calls out there. But the idea behind it is to find your falsetto. Some folks are going to find it just by singing a little higher than usual outside of your normal voice, looking for that head voice. So somewhere in the and just kind of stretching that out a little bit. And then sort of but finding the part where you can break your voice down. That's the first part. Yeah, I did ask people when I was, I've done this lecture for Lowell in the folklore course a couple times now. I always try to get people to sing along with me. Were you singing with me in the class? Did you sing out?
I think I almost did, but I had too many friends in there. I was too.
So now you're going to try it on the radio?
Exactly. That's the next logical step.
That's right. So let's find your falsetto. That's the first thing. Let's sing. Find an uncomfortably high pitch to sing in.
D. Ooh. D.
That sounds like your head voice right there. Find somewhere like E. Because you can't really belt it out like a real, you're not really going to. And you could just, instead of doing the cattle call with that melody, just hit like a note and hold it for a while and then try to drop back to your normal voice. So if you just tried like a E. Oh. And try to find that break. The part of the yodel is the snap, the vocal snap.
E-o.
I think if you start higher, you're going to have more success. Uncomfortably high.
I know. I need to get uncomfortable. Is the
E-o. E-o.
E-o. E-o.
So that's the spot. I think that's your vocal range where you're going to start. And if you do that for, it's not going to sound great, but you could do that for like a week of just trying to find your break. Because down is easier. So if you just do that, and think about octave range, you're going to look for whatever note you start on, try to hit an octave below that as quickly as you can. So it's like, and it's going to sound like a weird animal for a while. But once you get that, it's easier to go back up. Once you find it and you work on it and you just practice it a few times, pretty soon you're going to return, your voice wants to naturally return to that pitch. So you're just like, and then you can start adding the yo, delay yo.
All right, let me give a little delay.
Yeah, let's keep going. I'll sit this through for 3 to 4 weeks. I'm ready. That was a voice break in there. I heard it break in there.
I feel like a siren.
Yep.
E-o, e-o.
It is breaking in there. There is a certain point where you can feel that.
I do feel that.
Yeah. That's the muscle memory that you want to just keep feeling that where that voice breaks and working around that particular vocal range. There it is. And you're going back up. South by Southwest is in your immediate future.
I do see it.
Yeah. That's right. So that was the yodeling trick. For right now, I play in a country music band, and we play out, and I don't yodel in every song like Jimmy Rogers did, but I find it a very effective tool it's sort of like a solo break, because we have a four-piece band, so there's guitar solos, but if you don't want a guitar solo in every song, yodeling solos work too. And so it's sort of a good way to mix up the sound of the band. And it's usually a crowd pleaser. We usually do yodeling songs to end our sets or shows. So
does the crowd just lose it when you get up there on the EO?
I think people clap. yeah, because there's a bunch of yodeling showcase pieces, and I don't have a real high tenor, and I think the high tenors are really the ones who can really excel at yodeling, because you can hit that high last note and just let it ring. I sort of rely on speed and trick yodels, but I don't really hit the super high notes.
Can we hear a couple trick yodels?
Maybe? I didn't bring my guitar or anything. I could also just give you a recording that we've made.
Recording would be very helpful. Maybe we'll insert that here. That's stupid. I don't know why. Okay, yeah, we'll insert that right there. All right, my best Kenny Roberts try, buddy.
Learning how to Jeb, yodel.
How's your yodeling? You're over there running the boards.
Probably not too good. I mean, I've got a little bit of yodeling in my head. You know, I just think of Hank Williams.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure how well my skills would impart onto that. But I'm definitely open to learn.
All right. I love those Hank yodels. Those are probably my favorite, because instead of just doing the yodeling as an ornamental vocal flourish at the end of a line, Hank incorporated a lot of the yodels into the lyrics themselves. So it'd be like, got a feeling cold and blues, oh Lord, since my baby said goodbye. And he had a lot of cool ways to incorporate the yodel. Yeah, Hank's great. It's good stuff. So let's hear your yodeling attempt. Let's find your falsetto.
Okay.
Scoot back a little bit in the chat.
Yeah, we'll pull it up we'll pull up from here. So somewhere like yo,
there it is already yodeling right out the box. Oh,
well, I'm a natural, I guess.
How's your falsetto though? Let's hear that. Hold a pitch that's higher than you should feel comfortable.
Okay. Yo.
And then drop that down.
Yo. Dude, I've already got the break in there.
I know, you've already got the break. You don't really need to do the falsetto. But...
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm impressed with myself.
Look at that.
Can you do the...
Born to yodel.
Yodel-ay-o.
Kind of there.
It's a born natural yodeler.
Yeah, yodeling is for everyone, guys.
That's right. There was a book by Olivio Santoros called Yodeling is for Everyone, and he was a 10-year-old radio star who yodeled on his radio program, and he wrote this book called Yodeling is for Everyone.
When he was 10?
Huh? When yeah, he was like 10.
Oh, he wrote it when he was 10, too.
Oh, yeah, totally. He's like a really
small
kid.
So Lexi was like 60.
And he was just writing like all these nonsense syllables. He's like, try yodeling this. You can yodel this. And it's one of the best books out there on yodeling. It's probably 8 pages, but it's good. Yeah, it's a pamphlet. I should have said pamphlet.
Now we're gonna get back to a more normal kind of, it's a little more normal of a segment. So okay. What was the first music that you tried to make?
Oh, as a little kid, my dad was a minister, but he was also an opera singer, and he sang operas. He sang in two operas with Jan Pierce, the great New York Metropolitan tenor. That was sort of the pinnacle of his opera career. So it was always opera. He was always trying to get me to sing all the time, saying, sit down at the piano here. Let's sing some songs together. And I'd be like, nah, I don't really want to, Dad. But it was always around. And eventually, I was very grateful for him always pushing me to sing. My first, you know, I was playing trumpet through middle school, junior high, high school. At some point in high school, I was 18 when I got my first guitar. And that really set me on a trajectory to writing songs. And And then eventually I got an upright bass and got a mandolin, got a banjo, and got some other instruments. Tried to figure out how to play those. Yeah, pretty terrible at all of them, but I enjoy playing them.
How long were you waiting to get that guitar?
When I was a junior, I joined a punk rock band called the Fuzz Buckets. And there's actually one of the former Fuzz Buckets. It's crazy. He's here in Madison. He's a chef, and he started a restaurant called Cadre, and he also runs Lola's, a real popular restaurant and bar on the east side. And Evan's awesome, but he was in that band in Manhattan, Kansas. And
very common pipeline. People don't know this.
I know, the punk rock Manhattan, Kansas pipeline. But once I got into this band, I was playing trumpet and keyboard and singing. And eventually I wanted to, the guitar players were the coolest ones in that band. And so when I was 18, for Christmas, I got my first guitar. And I wanted a left-handed guitar. Because I'm left-handed. We went to the guitar store and they said, if you get a left-handed guitar, you're going to show up at every party where they have guitars and you won't know how to play them because they'll be right-handed. So if you've never played before, start with a right-handed guitar. And I thought that was brilliant advice. So I just learned to play right-handed and I love the thing. Yeah. That's my primary instrument now.
Let's see. So what have you been working on lately, music-wise?
I have a band here in Madison called Nate Gibson and the Stardazers, and we play a lot of Western swing, honky-tonk, a lot of yodeling, some rockabilly. I'm writing new songs all the time. I'm trying to get 15 original new songs so that we can start recording a record at some point. Yeah. My last recording project was one I finished a couple years ago, just before the pandemic, where I got all of those people that I had been interviewing for the Starday Records book that I was writing. I got them together in their late 70s, somewhere in their 80s. A couple were in their early 90s, and we made a record together. And we were backed up by Marty Stewart, Country Music Hall of Famer Marty Stewart, members of his band, The Fabulous Superlatives, which is my favorite band in the world. And so I got to make a record with my favorite band in the world, backing up my favorite country music legends. So that's kind of, I don't think I'll ever make anything cooler in my entire life. For me, at least, that was a labor of love project that came out just before the pandemic.
One thing that I've been meaning to ask is, what brought you to Madison?
Work. So I was in grad school in Indiana, and teaching as a grad school, working on my dissertation, and then a position for Ethnic American Music Curator came available. And so I had been working in archives and ethnomusicology and folklore, and this was a job that used all three of those skills, doing audio preservation and working on grants for Nordic American music and Nordic American folklife. And so all of those things came together, and I got hired with two other folklorists at the same time, and we managed the Nordic Folklife Grant, which is still going. It's been going the last 7 years, and I think will be likely renewed for another few years. But it's a great project. And then since then, my work at the Mills Music Library has become more central to my work at UW. So I'm the audio visual preservation archivist for the general library system. So now I do a lot of the music curation for Wisconsin Music Archives, but also all the digitization and preservation of these materials, and then part of my job is outreach to go do talks about the music collections we have on campus, and community engagement with collections.
What are our top music collections on campus?
Oh man, that is a great question. We have so many good ones. We have the Mayrink collection is the largest collection of Yiddish recordings, Yiddish language recordings in the world. That's a special one. We have the Local Center's Global Sounds collection, and that's all of the, you know, back in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, all these recordings were made in foreign languages because we had Polish-American groups, and recording companies would record Polish language records for that market. And then they really stopped doing that post-World War II, but we have tens of thousands, I would say, but many tens of 78 records that we are digitizing, and fieldwork collections of people interviewing musicians ethnic musicians of different ethnic groups in the upper Midwest, whether they be Finnish American musicians or Norwegian American or Swedish American for the Scandinavian stuff I'm doing, but Polish, Czech, German, and even more recent immigrant groups like Somali immigrant groups and all these things. And we're digitizing that music and streaming it online through Local Center's Global Sounds. It's cool.
Is that a website?
It's a website. Yeah, you could just Google Local Center's Global Sounds and you'll find the special collections UW page. And that's where I spend a lot of my time working on that collection. Leroy Larson collection's great. Arnold Munkel collection's great. There's a lot of good ones.
So throughout this interview, and also, and to quote your website, but also this is true of what you've said in just like the last like hour or so that we've been talking, but you describe yourself as an archivist, an ethnomusicologist, a folklorist, an audio preservation engineer, a curator, and a musician, and that is a lot of titles. Mm-hmm. Do you see any of these parts of you as your main thing, quote, in quotes?
As my main thing? Well, I mean, I just ran out of words. Like there's more you could add. Dog dad, you could add brother, you could add husband, you could add son, you could add, I mean, all of these different things are pieces of my identity, and depending on any given situation, you emphasize one over the other. But I, root beer enthusiast, car enthusiast, record collector, all record dealer, all these things, they're all much like when you ask where I'm from, I have difficulty just naming one place. If you ask what I do, I would have a difficulty naming one thing.
So tell us a little more about your dog.
Yeah, Lola the dog. She's so cute.
Your dog's cute? Can you put... I'm sorry, we can't. So the opinions expressed on this show do not reflect the views of WSUM, the University of Wisconsin-Madison, or its Board of Regents.
Every single one of those regents would love my dog. Little Lola is an elderly Maltese mix of something. We don't know how old she is, but she's slowed down considerably. She's deaf, but she's very sweet and docile and kind. Hmm. She gets scared and anxious when we're gone because she can't hear when we come and go.
Oh.
So, yeah, it's tough to be deaf or blind as a dog. We recently moved, and we're very concerned about her vision because we don't want her to be blind and deaf in a brand new environment with new smells and everything. But fortunately, she can still see and get around. So three cheers to Lola the doggo.
So you are a lecturer in the Meadwater School of Music. What is your lecture topics?
The last course I taught was on music sustainability and arts. So I was interested. I am on the grant review board for the American Scandinavian Foundation, and a lot of people submit grants to get funding, and the ASF has funding and they want to give it to people for projects. So I review those, and I got to thinking about who applies for grants for music and who gets those grants. Since being here at UW, I've been a co-writer on a little over $1.5 million worth of grants for various projects, and just thinking about when I was an undergrad, and even in grad school, I wasn't really thinking about the necessity of grants for public arts projects, but a lot of these music programs around our country wouldn't exist without them. You need to be a skilled grant writer in addition to a musician or or a music instructor or anybody in the music school, I think, would benefit from knowing more about how public arts funding works, how to get it, who gets what, how to apply for it, where the money comes from, and the ethical responsibilities of that. So that's what that course was about. How do we get music? How do we get public arts funding to sustain music communities? Who gets that money and why and how? The next class I'm teaching next year will be Music Cultures of the World, which is sort of the introduction to ethnomusicology course. Should be great. It's like 240 students. I'll teach it in the fall and the spring. Yeah, you should take it.
I'll put it on my, I am looking to fill out a All schedule right. that is very, it's pretty sparse right now. I need to make a full schedule exist so that I can drop most of it to take the intermediate level journalism classes that you can't, it's like a weird thing in the J school with the second semester courses that I won't get into, but it's more confusing than normal course application. I'll say that much.
Yeah, so you're doing J school and you're doing radio.
Yes, they go together.
Yeah, that's perfect. I'm glad they do. I heard your show with Shali, and it's awesome that she's doing radio too. And yeah, she's great since she's working now at WORT.
Yes, that's the next on my list. So at WORT, what I do is I do a segment on the local news there. What do you do?
I host Back to the Country, the traditional classic country music radio show from 9 to noon on Wednesday mornings. And that was started 26 years ago by Bill Malone. He was the first country music scholar published, first person to write an academic text about country music.
I knew, and you said a guy's name, and because of the way you've been talking about people this whole time, I knew he was going to have some title. He was going to be the king of the yodelers
Bill,
or whatnot.
Bill Malone is the king of country music scholarship. He is an incredible, he's 90 years old. He lives in Texas right now. He just moved back. He was here for 25 years, but he moved back to Texas with his wife, Bobby. They were actually my wife and I's wedding officiants last year, which was awesome. So I love this guy, and he started this radio program, but he moved back to Texas, so now he just hosts it from Texas once a month. And so I fill in one of the other Wednesdays, and there's two other hosts that each take a week. So it's a team approach to the show now, but that's, yeah, I love WRT. It's a great, can we say that on WSUM? I love WSUM too.
We're not rivals, we're friends.
That's all right, good. And yeah, we got our first, I started a radio program here at WSUM called, gosh, I'm blanking on the name now. It was like Collections with Connections, but it was to celebrate the music collections at Mills Music Library. We did that for a year, and it gave me some radio experience so that I could then do the radio show at WRT.
That's nice. So you've said, you know, there's the king. You gave him a more complicated title because I feel like king is not usually conferred to him. But I'd like to say in the description of this episode that we talked about three wise kings. So what are you the king of?
Oh, man. I don't know what I'm the king of, but I think if I am to be a known entity, it's likely for Starday stuff. I wrote the history of Starday Records. It was the largest independent country music record label in the 1950s and 60s. It started George Jones, Willie Nelson's first record, Roger Miller, Dottie West, a lot of great records they put out. And I wrote the history of that record label with the guy who founded the record label. And since that time, I've recorded with a lot of Starday recording artists, and I have performed a lot of festivals with Starday artists, and I've amassed the largest collection of Starday records in the world, and very, very much trying to keep that label alive. The name of my band is the Stardazers, to sort of continue to keep Starday Records and its legacy at the forefront of people's thoughts. So that's maybe why anybody would know what I do, but yeah. Or they just know Lola the dog and they think she's cute, and I do too.
Hmm. The king of having your specific dog. Now there's a title.
The king of, well, I'm not really a great dog trainer, so I can't say king of dog training. I don't know, the king of my own little world.
Well, that's a third wise king right there. So now I can say that in the episode description, because, and that'll be really good and cryptic for that. So one thing that I saw on your website was a section called pirate jokes. Can you tell us pirate jokes until we're sick of them?
Sure. What is a... Well, I guess the pirate joke book was written when I was in college, and my buddy Tim Barney and I wrote 101 pirate jokes. And the goal of that was because I had collected, you know, the Scholastic book fairs, those bookmobile things. I'd always buy the joke books, 101 jokes about school cafeterias, 101 jokes about alligators, 101 jokes about telephones. I have all these books. I have 101 jokes about pickles. And I just thought, pirates are awful. Pirates do terrible things. They really are bad. And yet children love them. And it's so bizarre and weird to me. So we wrote this pirate joke book to parody those children's joke books and to try to, yeah, I don't know. I think it's
was fun. It like, was it jokes about the real pirates?
It was jokes that were like children's book jokes. Where,
okay. I don't know. You just said parody and I imagined like, like just being like the horrible reality of pirates in a like children's joke book for it, which would be kind of awful, but
yeah, that's kind of what it was. That's kind of what's going on. There were definitely some jokes there that I shouldn't mention in association with my professional life. But it's not for kids. It was a joke book that was very much for our college peers that was making fun of life. Since that time, I've cleaned up my act. I recently co-wrote with two of my UW folklore colleagues, Marcus Cederstrom and Anna Rue, we wrote 101 Hodag jokes. And it's very much the same concept, taking, like, how do you keep a Hodag from charging? You would take away its credit cards. But that's, yeah, I mean, you could replace the word Hodag with anything. But
how do you keep a pirate from charging?
That joke is also in the pirate joke book. Yeah, 100%. Yeah. You've caught on. You've caught on. That's exactly what we're doing. So I did. There are some repeats from the Pirates of the Hodag book for sure. But we just took out. It's more family friendly. And my friend Lowell came over, who you know because he was teaching your folklore class.
And is currently teaching my folklore class. Is currently. This semester.
Awesome. So Lowell came over and he was like, this Hodag joke book is great. You should try to sell this to the Hodag store. And there's one in Rhinelander, a store that just sells Hodag merchandise. And I said, I don't know if they would be interested. And I asked them, and they were like, absolutely, we'll buy 15. And I was like, really? So I sent them up there, and then I followed up. I was like, hey, did you get, this was like a 2 or 3 weeks ago. I was like, hey, did you get those books? He's like, I love them. I've already sold a bunch. I'd like to buy 30 more. So just today, I got a check for 30 more Hodag joke books. And then a friend in New York bookstore was like, hey, are you selling Hodag joke books? And he bought 10. And so I can't believe it. I've sold 55 Hodag joke books in the last week. It's pretty awesome. So, yeah, but now I'm transitioning from pirate jokes, which are on the website, to Hodag joke book salesman.
What's a Hodag's favorite letter?
Oh, man. So here's the twist. What is it? You tell me.
R. I'm still thinking about pirates.
Yeah. Here's the twist on that one, because that one is in the pirate joke book. There is like a, have you seen the new pirate movie? It's rated R. And so we just changed it to, have you seen the new movie about Hodags? It's rated Hodag G. And just like put a big capital G. It doesn't make any sense at all. But I find it very funny, and it only makes sense if you know the pirate joke.
You need to read the pirate joke book before you read the Hodag joke book, right, to really get the Hodag joke book.
That's right.
So what's interesting is I haven't heard about Hodags outside of my folklore class.
Oh.
Besides in West Virginia. And I know that they're a Wisconsin staple, right? Am I correct?
Believe Gene Shepard discovered the Hodag in Wisconsin. That's true. Up near Rhinelander and 1890s, 1894, something like that.
Rhinelander has Hodag Fest every year. Big festival celebrating this mythical creature.
They do. There's a whole festival about it. And there's also the Hodag Country Music Festival, which is separate.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah, and there's the Hodag last year in a nationwide competition was voted the number one school mascot in the United States. Against all the other potential mascots out there.
I feel like it's got to be the Bulldog. There's got to be that one bulldog.
Yeah, the Hodag eats bulldogs, so...
It eats a lot of things, I've heard.
Yeah, but specifically all white bulldogs is its diet. A very strange, peculiar diet for the Hodag.
You're going to sell a lot of those joke books at the Hodag Fests 1, 2, and 3.
I was invited to be part of that Hodag Festival, which would have been awesome, but I'm unable to be in Rhinelander that weekend. But I think...
You got to send a guy with a box of books.
Yeah, the Hodag store will be selling them for sure. If you need a Hodag joke book yourself, go ahead and check out the Hodag store in Rhinelander.
So I think we're definitely reaching the end of our program by now. I mean, how much time are we at, Jeb?
We just reached an hour.
Unprecedented in length. Is there anything else you want to talk about before we finish?
No, I want to thank you guys for doing this. I think your program is great. I loved listening to Shali's episode and Dorothea Salo's episode, and I think you guys are doing awesome work. I appreciate you making the yodeling attempts to yodel with me. It's awesome. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thank you for coming on. I say this a lot, but you really do seem exceptional. You are an exceptional guest. Yes.
Thank you so much. I appreciate y'all.
This is Oliver in the production booth after recording. I emailed Nate, and I was really curious after this recording because I didn't get to hear King of the Yodelers, the song you recorded with Kenny Roberts. And, you know, I got Nate to send me a copy of the song. So here that is for your listening pleasure at the end of this episode.
Well, I don't understand most modern women, and I don't understand postmodernism, but there's one more thing even more puzzling to me. It's the sweetest sound that graced my ears. It rings so loud and crystal clear. That thing I'm talking about is yodeling. Now I have tried for quite some time to master that graceful yodel chime, but each time I try, something goes amiss. But I can't give up, it's my dream, so each day I practice my yodeling, and it usually sounds a little bit like this. That there cowboy yodel, so I went to see the King of the Yodelers himself. I figured he's the best, what could it hurt? So I bought a ticket to his concert, and after the show backstage, we finally met. I said, I like the yodeling that you do. He said, I'll teach you if you want me to. It's really not that hard, just listen and you'll see. Then he took a deep breath and began to sing, and I watched that man attentively as he showed me how he became the king. He sang,
yodeling.
Find all the old installments of this show at WSUM.org under the podcast tab. Goodbye for now, Madison. We will be back at the same time next week.